Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors, Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. Catherine Jinks was born in Brisbane, grew up in Sydney and Papua New Guinea, and now lives in the Blue Mountains. She has written dozens of books for readers of all ages, published in more than 10 countries. Catherine has won awards for writing for kids and adults, for writing crime and speculative fiction, and of course, for writing historical fiction. Her awards include a Victorian Premier's Literary Award and the Children's Book Council Book of the Year Award no less than 4 times. Catherine's latest book, just out this year, is Shepherd. It's the story of convict Tom Clay, caught poaching at the age of 12 and transported to the penal colony of New South Wales. Thank you, Catherine Jinks, for coming along to talk with us on Imagining the Past.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's a pleasure. So I wanted to ask, you write in many different genres, but what is it about historical fiction that keeps bringing you back to writing about the past?
Well, it's partly because the stories are already there. Like, you have to weave your story around something that's already there. You're going to a story that's already kind of written down, and then you just have to pick the bits that you like, you know what I mean? So it's half the work's done for you to some degree, you know.
Do you mean the stories of real people?
Yeah. I mean, it happens now, but it's somehow, because you've got the benefit of hindsight, you can see the full story. You know what I mean? Things that are happening now, sometimes they're not finished. But it's just, I feel like sometimes trying to put together a story that's set now is harder work than just looking at the stories that are already there, written down about history. That's one of the reasons.
Right.
I think the other reason is, you know, I did history at university. I was always rather obsessed with it. And I like to escape, which is part of the reason why I write. And it's an extra escape to get into a past world as opposed to the present world. You know, it just seems more different and kind of interesting.
The past is a different country.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And to live there for a while is more of an escape, I think.
So did you have favourite historical novels that you read as a kid that introduced you to the idea?
Let me see. The first ones were probably Georgette Heyer.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, sort of history fantasy, like the Mary Stuart Crystal Cave. And
right, yeah.
And then Jean Plaidy, I think I got into. And then I got into Alexander Dumas, who I think is just a master.
Yes. I think if you ask historical novelists of a certain generations, we all say the same similar things.
Yeah, exactly, right?
those names and Rosemary Sutcliffe.
Yeah, not so much her.
Right.
The one who did all the Greek books. Oh, geez.
Mary Renault.
That's the one. Yeah. I had a few of hers who I liked her.
So that's interesting, because that means that you weren't reading historical novels written for kids at that time. You were reading, I mean, they worked, say, for young adults, but they're not designed for kids particularly. You were reading
adult
books.
Well, the thing is, I don't think that there weren't. I also loved Kidnapped.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, there were a few, but there weren't masses of historical novels for kids, to be honest, I don't think. So I recall.
But we used to read...
There were some of those twins books. Do you remember those twins, the Twins in Rome? Twins in... I don't know, they were English, I think. I don't know if you ever saw them. And I think they were at some library or something. We never actually owned them. But there was, they used to put twins in all different kinds of historical periods. Anyway, I remember those. I don't know. Look, I was up in Papua New Guinea for a long time during when I was a kid. I mean, yes, most of my childhood was spent up there, and there weren't a whole lot of books. So got what I could.
And that's true for so many readers even now, isn't it? That, you know, you just read whatever you can get your hands on.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Your grandmother's Penny Dreadfuls, whatever it might be.
Yeah. And my mum was a big reader, so thank God. See, Mary Renault, she had some Mary Renault. She had, you know, she had various, she had Alexander Dumas. That's why I read them, because they were there, you know.
So I wanted to go back to that point you made about studying history at university, because I understand that the Pagan Chronicles were partly drawn on your obsession with medieval history.
That was Pagan's Crusade was the second book I wrote, and the second published book I wrote, and that was based on some stuff I studied, because I focused on medieval history at university, and there were a couple of incidents about the Crusades that I just thought would make a good book. I'd studied it already. I had all the material, and in those days you couldn't just plunge into the internet. You had to carefully gather up all your material and keep them in folders. I tried to write a. I was really into radio scripts at that time. I tried to write it as a radio script, and then I switched over and made it into a book.
Oh, that's interesting, because it's actually the sound of pagans, the pagan books, that still, I think, makes it, many years later, one of my favourite historical fiction. I wanted to ask you about that, because about the voice, the choices you made about Pagan's voice, the creative decisions
the choice
that
you make. The interesting thing is, I think, that's another thing about writing historical fiction. It's the choice you make about the voice that's much, there's just more to think about with an historical book than a modern one. So you have to work out how historical you're going to make that voice. With Pagan, I was afraid that kids wouldn't read it if it was too historical or too kind of, I suppose, formal. Which I don't think is true, actually, on reflection, but at the time I was worried. Plus, I'd done it as this kind of radio script. So what I did, I decided to do it the sort of the syntax, I suppose, is sort of modern, but the language, I mean, the way the words are put together is modern, but the actual words aren't necessarily modern. I never had anything too kind of, like, all my insults, like, you know, rockhead or whatever, they could be easily used back then. Like, I tried not to be too kind of modern in that respect. The slang words themselves weren't too modern, I think. Anyway, I did my best. Like, it was a kind of a mixture.
Christ in a cream cheese sauce.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah. That was taken out of the American editions, I might add.
Oh, was it? Because it was blasphemous?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Blasphemous Crusaders. So what words would you use to describe that voice?
I suppose cynical, humorous, intelligent.
He's sort of streetwise, isn't he?
Yeah, streetwise,
That's one of the things I kind of always liked about it, that you'd chosen to do something that was like anti-authentic in a way.
Yes, but that's the thing. Can I just say, it's anti-authentic in a way, but it's not.
Yeah.
When you really go into history, because I wrote a book called The Notary, which was about a notary.
Funnily enough.
It was a medieval murder mystery, and The Notary, he was a real piece of work. He was a bit of a larrikin, and he was not terribly religious, and it was just part of the air he breathed. He didn't think about it much, and he was, a bit of a womanizer. Basically, I wrote that as a particular kind of character who I think a lot of people would think was fairly modern in his character, not in necessarily the way he thinks, or his attitudes, but his character. And my old history tutor just loved it. He thought I nailed it. He said for a notary, it's a very hard thing to convey, because a notary was a very strange composite person who was educated but not educated as a monk, you know, or something. Like, he was on the verge of a modern kind of character, a notary. Notary was one of the first ones, and he thought I did nail it. People, yeah, it's a complex thing, those kind of characters that are a bit marginal. And when you look at medieval history, there's an awful lot of, I mean, completely crazy heretic sort of people who were against the establishment, you know, wandering around being sort of mad poverty freaks and things like that. They were not necessarily as fixed in the sort of social, you know, feudal pyramid as you think. So, yeah, anyway, so that was my thinking there.
So you're saying, are you, that you've got the, I don't actually like the word authentic, but you've got the worldview, the accurate worldview of somebody in that position at that time?
I think, yes, I think that's what I would say about it. I try to anyway.
But the words that come out of their mouths can be completely modern or in pagans.
Well, yes, the rhythms can be modern.
Right.
See, I always told myself, look, these people wouldn't even been talking English. They would have been talking, you know, Latin or some form of Languedoc or something like that. So, you know, you'd be translating it anyway, you know, so you might as well translate it that way, you know. Because when you read the translate, because a lot of my stuff, like when I wrote not pagan but the medieval murder mysteries, and it was first person, and you read all the old, you know, papal letters or monk sort of stuff translated from the Latin into English, there's a certain rhythm to it. And it's, you know, things like hugely long sentences, because you could do that in Latin. I don't know, it's a translation exercise anyway, really. So you might as well have a bit of freedom to it, you know, since modern English didn't sort of pop up until practically the Renaissance almost.
Yeah.
So
I think Hilary Mantel says she uses a modern voice in Wolf Hall, a modern voice with Tudor rhythms.
Ah, that's an interesting one. Hmm. Yeah.
So you're capturing the essence, I suppose, but not turning off the modern reader.
Well, it's like a Victorian novel. I mean, that's got a different rhythm, different words used, and you kind of use that, and then you kind of fiddle with it so that it's a bit more palatable.
Right. So can we fast forward then to the past couple of years while you've been writing Shepherd, which we might talk about the voice in that as well. So where did that story begin for you?
That story began when I tried to write, that story began because I was writing a screenplay based on I was hired to write a screenplay based on one of my historical fantasies, which is this Bogle book. It's in Australia, it's called A Very Unusual Pursuit. Anyway, I wrote that and I thought I'd like to try to write a screenplay of an original idea. So I wrote the screenplay of The Shepherd as a screenplay. And then, you know, nobody was particularly interested in that. So I thought, well, I like this story. I'll turn it into a book, which wasn't too hard to do it from the screenplay. I need a little bit more background stuff, but... So that's how that happened. So that's why it was meant to be a thriller horror movie. So that's why it's kind of a fairly fast-paced piece of work.
And very visual too, that makes perfect sense.
Very
visual.
Yeah. So my stuff tends to be pretty visual. That's why people think it would actually make good film, even if it wouldn't be, because a lot of my books sort of, they're not necessarily structurally would make a good film, but because they're so visual, people think they would.
So does that mean you said you had to chase up a few extra things? In terms of the research process and your work, we'll take Shepherd as an example. Do you do a lot of the research at the beginning, or are you doing it all the way through?
The thing is, I suppose both, to be honest, because what I do, I write a bit more like a screenplay writer. I very much plan beforehand. I write a big old synopsis before I even start chapter one, so, which is not necessarily what all novelists do. They tend to follow their noses, some of them, but I don't, because that way I don't have to do huge amounts of editing at the end. So I do a lot of the research at that point when I'm planning and preparing and doing the synopsis and working out the plot. And then while I'm actually writing, an example of this is when I wrote this, I sent in Shepherd and it was accepted, and then I had to edit it. And the editor came back and said, I'd like a bit more about his background. So therefore I had to go off and think up some more stuff for the main character and research, say, what was it? The jail where he went, and which is amazing now that you can get that stuff on the internet. It's amazing. On the internet. Amazing. And I suppose with Shepherd too, I already had a lot of the basis stuff anyway, because I've done a fair bit of, I wrote The Dark Mount, which was set in sort of 1840s Australia. So I had that basic background inside me anyway. I kind of knew the world. So I didn't have to do, I had to do some specific research, but I didn't have to start from scratch on that.
So is there anything that you discovered that surprised you in the research?
For Shepherd?
Yeah.
A lot of it was done, of course, on Trove. Trove, I cross myself and salute, because Trove is the greatest thing ever.
How much do we love Trove?
I mean, we all love Trove so much. I mean, I had to do Dark Mountain on, you know, on bloody, what do you call them, those awful things that you have to feed through the machine.
Microfilm.
Yeah, but all the newspapers are on that stuff, and it's just a nightmare. I had to do it on that. And now I've got Trove, and it was like, oh, my God, it's so easy. Yeah.
So if people don't know what Trove is, it's the National Library's search engine, if you like, of all the different collections all around the country. Every major library participates in it, and it's got thousands and thousands of pages of particular
all the newspapers. All the newspapers. So I'm just trying to think, did anything surprise me? I mean, I was more surprised by stuff when I was doing my non-fiction a couple of years ago called Charlotte and Victorian Era. That was more surprising. This one, I don't think...
Or anything particularly fascinating.
Well, I suppose the only thing I found surprising was how much I found on the internet about certain subjects, which you would never believe. Like, oh my God, an entire book about poaching in the 19th century. Fantastic. You know, like, I mean, all this, I suppose it's just a surprise of how much you can actually find.
Yeah, and it changes all the time. Aren't we lucky?
Aren't we lucky? And aren't we lucky that people will actually just put it all up there, you know, take the time to put it all up there? Amazing.
So I was wondering too, these recent books, you've had to address the complex question of capturing settler attitudes to Indigenous people during the first wave of colonialism. And I wondered what your thinking was around that and how you approached it.
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one. Even the presence of Indigenous people in a story is tricky these days, because I don't want to be taking somebody else's story. But, and yet, you don't want to ignore them because they were there. And so I looked up, there was a lot of stories in the newspapers, and I kind of, it was partly the stories in the newspapers about the awful things that happened, and partly being more of a fiction writer and putting myself in the shoes of somebody who's come to this new country, and there are people out there about whom they know nothing and has been told usually pretty grim stuff. So you've got to kind of, but on the other hand, from the point of view of a person who's a poacher, who completely learned how to read the English countryside, comes to a new countryside, is surrounded by these strange signs that they have to try and read, and find themselves, I suppose, more and more interested and confused and kind of focused on this Aboriginal presence around them, which they don't completely understand, but who, in a way, these people are kind of a guide for a person who wants to read the land the way the Aborigines do. So that was kind of I just tried to put myself in his shoes for that, particularly someone who's very ignorant.
And young,
yeah.
Did you have access to a diary or journals of anybody like that?
Oh, in the past I've read convict stuff. Oh, there was some, yeah, there was one oh, God, what was he? He wrote, I can't think of his name, I'm terrible at names. He wrote a book about his experiences, I think it was mostly in Victoria, but when he lived with a tribe for a while. He was a convict who lived with a tribe, and then he left the tribe, and then he wrote about it. And I read that.
Oh, William Buckley.
Look, probably. You're probably better at... these things, if I need the name, I'll remember it. Yep. If I don't really need the name,
You'll remember it at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, so I read that, and that was really, really helpful. Yeah, but that was probably the main thing.
You also got lots of tiny details in the story that make it come alive, like how to reload a musket quickly.
Yeah.
How do you balance including the telling details with not including all the fascinating things that you discover that you wish you could put on the page?
Oh, well, that's the trick. Can I just say that is one of the main tricks of historical writing. Actually of journalism too. You find the thing that anchors you to reality, and they're often little details. And you don't have to put a lot of them in. You just have to scatter them through, and they will give immense sense of reality to, you know, texture. But you just have to kind of identify it, and there's some kind of trick to that. I don't know. I've just picked it up over the years, working out what to put in and what to leave out. It's almost like just putting one thing in. You don't have to put anything else in. It's just that one thing that will just do it for you.
And leave the rest out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't even have to know it all. It's just, you just have to, like, particularly in that book, it was if you could get a stuff about coursing hares or something and just put a few things in about that, it sounded so much like I knew what I was talking about. you know, and you don't actually have to know everything that a poacher knew, but you just have to know a few things and it works.
It does work. I suppose one of the things about something like How to Load a Musket is just people understanding how long it takes.
Well, when I was doing it as a thriller horror film, I thought, see, that in itself is one of the most tense things you can put in. Something's coming and you're having to load this damn musket and it takes forever. I mean, and it's getting closer and you're still loading and it's not like nowadays where you can just point a gun and fire it, you know, three times. You have to do all of that. And I just thought, what a great tension ramper upper that is.
Yeah, so it is a detail, but it's also doing other things in the story.
That's right.
So what do you do if your research lets you down, if you come across a documented fact that doesn't support the story that you've imagined? Are you one of those writers who will bend history to your will?
I've always, because I research at the same time as I'm creating the plot, see, that's what I like about Alexandre Dumas. He takes what's there and he weaves his people around it. And I've always been like that. That's the thing. That's what I talked about. The stories are half there. I let the history lead me. I don't ever have this idea. And see, that's part of the problem with some people, I think. When you read historical fiction that's more like modern people in fancy dress, they've got this idea and they're almost pushing against history to create it. I let the history lead me. I don't do it the other way.
Right. So that's in terms of plot and voice,
yes, that's
and character,
right.
All yep. of it. With that in mind, I just wanted to come back to Tom Clay's voice in Shepherd, because it is it does sound, to my ears anyway, very different to the voice of, you know, the pagan or someone like that, that it is more, because it's closer, I suppose, in time, it is more in tune with the modern ear.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's like, I've written stuff like, for example, The Gentleman's Garden, which is very Austen. Like, it's a very, you know, antique-sounding style. I often try to do that. Now, with Tom Clay, it was written as a YA. It was supposed to be quite simple and not too, like, the sentence structure's not too complex, simple the way Tom is. I mean, he's not simple in the terms of brain, you know, he's not stupid, but his world is fairly black and white and straightforward, and, you know, that he doesn't deal in very complex thought processes and things either, philosophy or anything like that. So I tried to do that, and look, honestly, I had some much slightly more antique syntax language construction with him, and it was taken out.
Right.
It was obviously felt to be not modern enough. I was too tight. I had to loosen it up, all this sort of stuff. Like, yeah.
In the editing process.
Pardon?
So that was
in the editing process, yes.
So you then are trying to balance it for the modern reader.
Yes.
Is it a creative decision or is it a pragmatic decision? Obviously, the editors have made different pragmatic decisions.
It's a pragmatic decision.
Yeah.
It's to do with trying to sell a book, because, quite frankly, it's so hard now that everything has to be focused on that.
So can you in the case of Tom, can you hear his voice?
Oh, like, yeah, yeah.
When you're writing.
Oh, yeah.
And how does the magic work that you can hear his voice in your head and somehow it comes out on the page?
Oh, look, it's...
Is it magic?
Yeah, I mean, look, you just... It's a process and you find your character usually in the first... You got your character sort of sketched out in the synopsis, but the real magic of the language happens when you actually start writing the first chapter. And if you haven't got it by the end of the first chapter, you have to go back and get it. That's what happens. I just find that first chapter and I manage to kind of sink into who he is in his head.
And the voice comes out right.
And the voice comes out. And sometimes you have to adjust it a little bit, work it out. It takes maybe 1 to 2 chapters, but you work it out.
So now you look at it in its edited phase or stage. Does it still sound right to you? Like, does it still sound like his voice?
Yeah, because the whole thing of editing is, well, this is a suggestion from the editor. Well, you think, well, I don't know, maybe not that, but maybe this is the compromise we can do or whatever. Like, I'm not going to let something out that I don't feel is true. I remember at one point the editor, look, she was really smart, and she suggested this joke. And a couple of times, I think, suggested a funny kind of thing to add to what Tom was thinking, whatever. And I said to her, look, that's really good. And if it had been Pagan, yeah, absolutely. But Tom doesn't have a sense of humour.
Right.
Life is way too serious for him to think it's funny, you know. It's too dire. So, and that's the point, he really can't stand Rowdy because he thinks that everything's a joke, you know. So I couldn't put that in. Because I felt it wasn't him, you know. So even though it was good, like it was funny and I liked it, but I couldn't put it in for that character.
Because that's the depth of knowledge of the character that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a very subtle editing process in a way that's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you've got a good editor, it's a subtle process.
Yeah. Well, whatever you're doing, it totally works.
Oh, thanks.
So congratulations on the new book. I'm looking forward to people getting their hands on it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. People seem to like it when they read it. They say, oh, I couldn't put it down because it's one of these, you know, action-type books.
So. Pretty exciting. And thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. And
well, thank you for talking to me.
And we'll see you at the conference
in
October.
At the conference. Yay. I can't wait, actually. I love being surrounded by history buffs. It's lovely.
Yes, talk about nothing but historical fiction for days on end.
Yeah, and like going on and on and on about these things where other people can't bear to listen to you anymore, but history buffs will.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.